Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Sinclair Mackay talking about the secret life of Bletchley Park.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction, and thank you also very much. It's wonderful to be at Chalk Valley History Festival. It's absolutely terrific. Hello? Can you hear me? Ah, here we are. I was just saying thank you so much for asking me. It's so nice to be at Chalk Valley, at the brilliant, brilliant festival. And so the first thing I'm going to present you with is a picture of this, well, a slightly odd house in a slightly overlooked corner of Buckinghamshire. It was originally set in over 700 acres of landscaped grounds. As you can see, it's not quite Brideshead, but it does have a ballroom with a very ornate ceiling. And if, during World War II, you'd been a Luftwaffe pilot flying overhead, or even a Nazi spy on the ground, you wouldn't have spotted anything at all unusual here. Now, of course, huge numbers of country houses all over England had been requisitioned for the war effort. Simply to look at, this was one of the least remarkable. And that's what made it perfect. Bletchley Park. Until the late 1970s, perhaps even later, most people had never even heard of the estate, still less about the utterly crucial role that it played in the war. It lay deep in the shadows of secrecy, its significance understood by a very few. Yet this property played host to the most extraordinary feats of intellectual brilliance. It was here that vast battles across the world, on land, at sea, were decided. It was here, almost incidentally, that the computer age came into being. So imagine you yourself being recruited to work there in 1939. Perhaps you're a maths undergraduate, or a linguist with a gift for German. Maybe you're a chess champion, a cryptic crossword expert. Maybe you've got a particular brilliant aptitude for music and you've got a capability of reading full orchestral score. Maybe you're an expert in Egyptology and you spend your entire life piecing together fragments of ancient papyri. Maybe you're a volunteer for the Women's Royal Navy and you've sat a special intelligence test, the exact provenance of which no one has quite explained to you. So imagine then getting the summons. Often it came by telegram and sometimes it simply read, you are to report to Station X. Many of the young people recruited to this mysterious institution with no idea of what they were being drawn into traveled by rail from all over the country. And they often arrived deep into the evening, sometimes late at night. Now, during the war, of course, blackout of all lights was complete. So imagine then, disembarking at the railway station in total darkness. The train draws off into the night, its red taillights disappearing. And in that silent, smoky darkness, you find the stairs leading to an iron bridge, then down to the ticket office, where your contact is waiting for you. Now, perhaps you might be expecting a long drive in a car, but actually your destination is within a very easy walking distance. There's some parkland, fringed with a fence and a roll of barbed wire at the top, a military police sentry hut, a driveway framed with elms, and then the house. Now, in the faint silver moonlight, it might have seemed rather impressive, even romantic. In the daylight, a little less so. Some of the debutantes who arrived here thought it very much less grand than the properties that they were used to staying at for the weekend. The Honourable Sarah Baring, for instance, thought the house was perfectly monstrous. But that is exactly what makes the story of Bletchley Park so beguiling. For this house, and all the green wooden huts and the white concrete buildings that later materialised in the grounds all around played host to what George Steiner described as one of the greatest achievements of the 20th century. It was here that the German Enigma codes, considered completely insoluble, with millions upon millions of potential combinations, were cracked by a team of the country's finest and wildest intellects. Their efforts, which had an effect on everything from the sinking of the Bismarck, the triumph at El Alamein, to the turn of fortunes on the Eastern Front, are reckoned by some to have shortened the war by 2 years. According to codebreaker and intelligence historian Professor Sir Harry Hinsley, it may actually have been 3 years, because without Bletchley's intelligence, D-Day and the Normandy landings might not have worked at all. Yet all these triumphs sprang from what one veteran described as apparent anarchy.
And in some ways, the house was a perfect reflection of the eccentric sensibility of these codebreakers. Some who worked here said that it was their university. Messenger girl Mimi Galilee, who was a mere 14 years old when she signed the Official Secrets Act to work there, said that she looked back on the place with love. Now, there's a road leading up to the house and the pretty lake before it. In the darkness of the blackout, some women dreaded walking along that path at the changeover of a midnight shift. Not because of predators, but because apparently in the summer months there were huge numbers of frogs, which they trod on, and they hated doing that. The house always had quite a colourful history. In earlier years, Bletchley Park, which had been built in the late 1880s, was owned by this chap, the local squire, wealthy stockbroker, and erstwhile MP, Sir Herbert Leon. He and his wife, Lady Leon, presided over a very busy establishment. There were dozens of servants. In that respect, they would have given Downton Abbey a run for its money. There were servants for the house, for the stables, also for the extensive gardens, plus the hothouses. There were servants there specially to look after the carnations. The Leons were very important local employers in Bletchley. They were responsible, at the house's height, for a workforce of about 200 people. And the park was a terrific social magnet. Noted particularly for glamorous weekend parties hosted by Lady Leon. Now, the building itself might have later made architectural historians shudder with distaste. There was one American architect who became a codebreaker who came over to Bletchley in the 1940s, and he shuddered when he saw it. He described the interior as being an example of lavatory Gothic. But that was in the 1940s, when all things Victorian were loathed, especially in Britain. And actually these days, the Leon's colourful tastes, from the exterior copper cupola to the interior dark wooden panelling, the occasional outbreak of stained glass, is viewed a little more kindly. Now, added to this was a huge amount of local community life. The Leons were very, very prolific in all their dealings, from the local hunt to the local hospital to local schools. But the life of every grand house fades in time. And after Sir Herbert's death in 1937 and the death of Lady Leon, the family decided it was time to sell up. By 1938, the property was acquired by the very forward-thinking head of the Secret Intelligence Service, Sir Admiral Hugh Sinclair. It was a canny purchase. He could see what was coming. Now, at this time, here we are, at this time, the cryptology section of the Foreign Office, which was then known as the Government Code and Cipher School, was based here in St. James's Park, central London. Now, Admiral Sinclair was casting about for an alternative base in the case of war. They were working on the assumption that war would bring immediate, devastating bombing raids to London. Now, one initial idea had been to house the codebreakers under this St. James's Park HQ in dormitories. Admiral Sinclair realised that if they did that, the codebreakers would all murder each other. So they didn't. They settled on the smarter idea of finding a quiet spot in the country and somewhere which happened to be equidistant between Oxford and Cambridge, which were, of course, to be, at the start, the main recruiting locations. Young undergraduates, keen mathematicians, taken aside quietly by their tutors, doors closed, and asked if they would like to get involved in unspecified war work. Many seemed to guess instantly what it was all about. There were some who didn't guess instantly and thought that they were being asked to be James Bond-style spies. They thought they were going to be flown into over enemy territory and get involved in missions of derring do. Then when they found where they were, they were like, oh, this, code-breaking. They soon found their enthusiasm. The director of the Government Code and Cipher School back then was Alistair Denniston. Now, he had a very distinguished history in code-breaking. He'd been working on enemy codes since the First World War, when the department was referred to as Room 40. Now, Denniston had, like all the other codebreakers, actually, a very interesting hinterland. Apart from anything else, he had competed in the 1908 Olympics at hockey. He had a very shrewd understanding of human nature and how to get the best out of his cryptologists. It wasn't easy, because bringing a semblance of order to all those assembled intellects was like trying to herd grasshoppers. Denniston understood that for Bletchley to work, for the lightning bolts of inspiration to strike again and again, he would have to foster a freewheeling, free-thinking atmosphere. This he did, much to the consternation of the Foreign Office and the War Office. They were also taken aback at the apparent lack of hierarchy. Was Bletchley a military or a civilian establishment? It seemed that it could be whatever each individual codebreaker wanted it to be. There were some codebreakers who wore uniform, for instance, but they did so largely in order to get free train travel. And this schizoid uncertainty was summed up brilliantly by Brigadier John Tiltman, a very brilliant senior cryptanalyst, fantastic at handling Japanese ciphers, who always wore uniform himself. Rather natty tartan trews, I think, were part of his uniform. But he was always bewildered when he saw younger members of his team turning up in uniform. He asked of one codebreaker, "Why are you wearing those damn silly boots?" Back in the days of World War I, cryptology and technology were not yet interchangeable, and the great experts at codebreaking were largely classicists, men and a few women who were expert in handling ancient texts and long-extinct languages. Codebreaking was seen as an art as much as a science, a poetic riddle as much as a mathematical one. But in the interwar years, when the government code and cipher school turned its focus onto the fledgling Soviet Union, all that started to change. And Denniston and his colleagues were keenly aware of a new technological challenge they faced. It was the Enigma machine, a compact marvel of bakelite, wood, and brass, so simple-seeming, a little like a portable typewriter. At the top, rotors with letters on them, which would move with each keystroke. The keyboard itself, type in your letter, and the encoded letter is lit up on the lamp board above. Later models included a stecker board underneath too, which hugely increased the already awesome number of potential letter combinations. So you set up the Enigma machine according to the settings that have been provided to you by HQ. They change every 24 hours. You put the brass wheel rotors into their start position. Then, with the message before you, you start encoding each letter. Having done so, the encrypted message is then radioed over in five-letter groups. Now, you look at that machine, the first time I looked at the Enigma machine, I thought, oh, easy. Surely anyone could crack that. The diabolical genius, the absolute diabolical genius of this, the first electric encryption machine, was that no letter would be encoded the same way twice. A would become P, but the following A might become a T. There was apparently no way to spot recurring patterns, no regularity to get a hold on. Where would you even begin? It was first marketed in 1919 by a German called Arthur Scherbius. Now, this encoding device, and we might unblushingly call it a design classic, was originally devised for banks and insurance firms. Its military value soon became obvious. In 1926, a revised model of the machine was offered around, most notably to the British. They turned it down. But the technology was bought up by the German Navy, and once they had it, they set to work on improving its security yet further. Soon, these machines were used by the entire German military. And as time went on, these ingeniously portable machines that could be used anywhere, from U-boats to the middle of the desert, numbered in their thousands. Three Polish mathematicians, among them the very distinguished Marian Rejewski, were the first, incredibly, to get a lever into those encrypted letter groups. In 1932, they had a breakthrough, a system involving perforated sheets so complicated that it almost gives me a nervous breakdown to even think about it, so I'm certainly not going to start describing it here. But the point was that they were the first to realize that this impossible system could actually be cracked. Marian Rejewski later said, "Wherever there is arbitrariness, there is also a certain regularity. There is no avoiding it." Now, meanwhile, back in England, Room 40 code-breaking veteran Dilly Knox, Alfred Dilwyn Knox, was also applying himself to this mind-fangling challenge. Knox was a brilliant classicist. He was a huge fan of Lewis Carroll and the logic-fangling adventures of Alice in Wonderland. He was a brilliant classicist. He was a former Cambridge apostle, and he had a temper like Vesuvius. He worked with ancient papyri, piecing together fragments of texts in languages long vanished. Now, even as a boy, Knox's intellect was remarkable. He once wrote to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle in order to point out some logical inconsistencies in The Sign of Four. Basically, it was Dilwyn Knox versus Sherlock Holmes. And who won? It was Dilly Knox. Also, you didn't want to get into a car with him. He was a terrifying driver, because he would zip through the narrow lanes of the Chilterns at top speed, never stopping at any crossroads, while at the same time reciting Milton and waving his hands around. Knox worked together with Josh Cooper in untangling the maze of communications from the fledgling Soviet Union, but he also worked hard upon Enigma, and during the Spanish Civil War, he had some success in cracking that version of the encoding machine. It was just weeks before Poland was invaded in 1939 that Dilly Knox travelled over there to finally meet with the three pioneering mathematicians. First, so that they could share their intelligence, but second, so that this intelligence could escape Poland ahead of the rampaging Nazi forces. And with an invaluable head start from the Poles in cracking Enigma, Knox and Alastair Denniston returned to Britain with hours to spare. When war was declared on September 3rd, 1939, Bletchley Park was practically the only institution that seemed fully and properly prepared. Not that they had found a way at that point of cracking the codes on a daily basis. That was to come later, with some piercing psychological insight into the minds of German Enigma operators. But Bletchley Park was up and running. The first of the recruits, from the undergraduates to the very smart, posh debutantes, were beginning their work. Now, oh, there are some people beginning their work there, but I'm going to get straight onto this young lady, Mavis Lever, who was aged 19, just about going on 20, when she was recruited into Bletchley Park. She was a brilliant linguist who had been working at the Ministry of Economic Warfare, and she was thinking of training to be a nurse. And a friend said to her, "Oh, no, you don't. You're going to the Foreign Office. I've got someone for you to meet at the Foreign Office." And with that, she was inducted straight away into Bletchley Park because her German was very, very good. But she also had that cryptic crossword sensibility, which was so absolutely vital. She could look at apparently random letters and see the patterns forming out of them. She was sent to work with Dilly Knox in a Bletchley side building known as the Cottage. Now, this was at a time when women did not have a voice in the workplace. Mavis Lever worked to make hers heard. And indeed, so brilliant was she at wrangling with the Italian Enigma codes that in 1941, she was directly instrumental in the British winning the Battle of Cape Matapan. Now, incidentally, it was also at Bletchley Park that Mavis met the love of her life, a Hut 6 codebreaker called Keith Beatty. One might say that their eyes met across a crowded Enigma machine. Shall we not say that? Theirs was not the only romance at Bletchley. A great many other couples met there and fell in love. It was a seething hotbed of romance. Linguist Sheila McKenzie, newly recruited to the park, devoted some of her off-duty hours to Bletchley's Highland Dancing Club, at which she met Hut 6 codebreaker Oliver Lorne. Again, what followed was decades of happy marriage, and more on the Highland dancing later. Bletchley Park gave many young women a voice at a time when it was very rare for women to be heard professionally. Now, obviously, there was some sexism. Mavis Beatty was not pleased when she discovered that women who worked with Dilly Knox were referred to lasciviously as Dilly's fillies. But for its time, Bletchley Park could be remarkably forward-looking. In those wooden huts, women's ideas and inspirations had equal weight to men's. And certainly, the idea of young women telling older men how to solve certain problems was noted later with some wonder by the American cryptographers who came over to England to join forces on the German codes after 1941. One such American guest at Bletchley Park was the very distinguished Telford Taylor. He, together with future Secretary of State Bill Bundy, both reminisced with huge affection about their time at Bletchley Park and about the society of tea drinkers which they found. Indeed, Bill Bundy later declared, "Though I've done many interesting things and known many interesting people, my work at Bletchley Park was the most satisfying of my career." As chaotic and eccentric as the codebreakers were, the grounds of Bletchley Park came to reflect this rackety anarchy. At the start of the war, those green wooden huts were springing up in the grounds like mushrooms. The house itself was never big enough to accommodate the code-breaking activity. Now, these wooden huts were freezing in the winter and suffocating in the summer. There was a perpetual fog of tobacco smoke within them. And there was never enough room in the house either for people to live. So these very clever young men and women instead found themselves billeted upon some rather startled Bletchley locals. Some of the debutantes were rather startled too, because many of the properties in Bletchley didn't have indoor lavatories. In fact, one of the first internal memos sent at Bletchley was about how smart young society girls might respond to the slightly less glamorous life in Bletchley, and whether it might prove too much of a shock. Luckily, they were made of more robust stuff, though one recruit, in a momentary fit of despair, took to her bed with a jug of gin and orange. Now, the Honourable Sarah Baring, I think, yes, I've got a picture of her. The Honourable Sarah Baring, who you see on the left, told me that whenever she got any precious leave, she and her friend, Ursula Henniker Major, who had a romance, I think, with Prince Philip, though before he became the consort of Her Majesty the Queen, obviously, they would race straight down to the railway station whenever they got precious leave. They would catch the express to London and then straight off for cocktails at Claridge's, where the marvellous doorman would tell them who was in the bar that evening. All this at the height of the Blitz. Now, from the very start, the directorate of Bletchley Park knew what an awesome logistical job they had. Not merely a matter of breaking into the most fiendish codes devised, it was doing so on an epic scale. Think of all those thousands of messages being sent day after day, from theatres of war right the way across the world. The Bletchley miracle was not merely that they devised ways to listen to the very heart of the enemy's communications, it is the fact that they could do so with all communications. Now, such a vast enterprise would need a fast multiplying workforce, and after an era of classicists, this was now the turn of the mathematicians. Here we see the young Alan Turing, who was just 27 when war was declared. He had been on Bletchley's radar for a while. He was the author of the 1936 paper on computable numbers, which I'm sure you've all read, and he had been signed up secretly some months beforehand. Turing was as interested in philosophy as he was in maths. And we see that he brought some of that to his code-breaking work. He had been theorizing for some time about machines that could be programmed, machines that could remember, machines that might develop the logical capacities of the mind, perhaps even machines that could hold the essence of a soul. He had all sorts of hinterland, Alan Turing. As one curious fact about him was that he was extremely bad at cryptic crosswords. It's one of the ironies of Alan Turing. Famously, Bletchley Park set a cryptic crossword competition to see if they could reel in a few more recruits. This cryptic crossword was in the Telegraph in 1942. If you could solve it in under 12 minutes, you were ushered straight to the War Office and then signed up for all sorts of code-breaking duties. If Alan Turing had set that test, he would never have got to Bletchley Park. But he obviously triumphed at Bletchley. Together with senior code-breaker Gordon Welshman, he and Gordon Welshman came up with the bomb machine. Now, this was not the first computer, not quite, but it was nonetheless a brilliant and inspired work of engineering. These vast bulks, I think we see a picture of them being assembled at Letchworth here. We've got, I think, another picture here, yeah. These vast bulks, wardrobe-sized things, rotating drums, spinning their way through countless combinations of apparently random letters. The first of the bomb machines were built in conditions of super secrecy by the Letchworth Tabulating Company, and they came into service in May 1940, at the time when the British soldiers were stranded at Dunkirk. These machines didn't break codes by themselves, but they were super fast in checking off combinations if they were fed a crib, a decrypted word or phrase from the message concerned, and pretty soon their numbers multiplied. Who would operate these extraordinary machines? This is when Bletchley Park welcomed the first of a wave of wrens. Now, the work, as you get an indication here, was focused and incredibly arduous. There were nervous breakdowns. On a 24-hour rota, young women would have to tend to these monsters, enduring the noise and the heat, setting, resetting, checking when they came to stops, fiddling around with tweezers when some of the incredibly fussy wiring at the back went wrong. Nothing else to think about but the clickety-ticking noise, the very fine sprays of oil that would spoil blouses for an incredibly concentrated 8 hours at a time. Now, the work being done at Bletchley held a very special fascination for Winston Churchill, who famously described all who worked there as the golden geese who never cackled. It wasn't just the astounding intellectual achievements he admired. He loved the single-minded dedication of all those who were making these quantum jumps to outwit the enemy. But this also meant that everyone, from professors to teenage messenger girls, had to sign the Official Secrets Act as soon as they crossed the threshold. This obviously was the gravest secret of the war. If the Nazis had ever suspected that their insoluble codes were not merely being broken, but smashed on an industrial scale, they would have intensified the complexity of their coding machines 100-fold, which might well have crippled the entire cipher-cracking operation. Remarkably, and especially now in a world of Twitter and WhatsApp, remarkably, all these thousands of young people said not a word. The secret was safe. But there was the odd accidental slip. Academics at drinks parties might get a little tiddly and hint at the great work that they were engaged upon. Young wrens at dances with American soldiers might brag a little about the incredible machinery they were working with. But as memos in the archives show, the security services were always very fast to act and to give these people what they called a fright. With this combination, though, of fast-witted young mathematicians and dedicated young wrens, Bletchley started making good inroads into Enigma traffic. And some codes, notably the naval Enigmas, they were to prove more intractable, but as the war developed, so did the ingenuity. As particularly demonstrated by Alan Turing and his Hut 8 team pitting their almost uncanny mathematical intellects against those naval Enigmas and proving invaluable in the Battle of the Atlantic. And as the ingenuity developed, so too did the technology. Now, I think I've got a picture here of... That was someone keeping a secret, by the way. A picture here of Dr. Tommy Flowers. He's one of Bletchley Park's greatest unsung heroes. He was a man referred to at the time by some as the crafty Cockney. He was a great deal more than crafty. Tommy Flowers, or Dr. Thomas Flowers, to give him his full due, was the engineer who helped bring the computer age into being at Bletchley Park. He was born in London's East End, and he worked incredibly hard to put himself through night school. Dr. Flowers was with the GPO Research Department at Dollis Hill in North London as the war broke out. His terrific technical expertise was needed. Bill Tutt, Alan Turing, and his old tutor, Max Newman, had theorised about the possibility of a much faster, more advanced code-checking machine to deal with German advances in this field. Tommy Flowers, in that great British spirit of improvisation, actually built the thing out of his own pocket and made it work in the face of some initial derision. There were those who questioned his use of valve technology, others who couldn't imagine how a self-educated man from the slums of the East End could come up with something that was beyond Oxbridge-educated colleagues. There was a lot of snobbery. But this was the legacy of Dr. Flowers, now acknowledged and celebrated by engineers at Apple and Google and computer engineers all over the world. This was the Colossus. This was the machine from which all computers sprang. And it was also thanks to this work of engineering wonder that Bletchley Park codebreakers were able to read messages from Hitler himself. Now, as an aside, these futuristic contraptions had one other unauthorized use. They gave off quite a bit of heat, and when no one was looking, the Wren operators found them useful for drying underwear. Now, the work was intensely pressurized. Now, even if all the young codebreakers and Wrens were not told, for reasons of security, the exact meaning of their decrypts, they were under no doubt that their efforts could mean the difference between life and death. And on top of this, Professor Max Newman, who we see here, who would go on after the war with pioneering computer work, he was an innovative boss. He would hold meetings at Bletchley where everyone, not just the mathematicians, not just the boffins, but linguists, administrative staff, everyone, were invited to chip in with ideas. He wanted everyone to feel intimately involved. Now, I was very privileged in the course of research to meet codebreakers such as Keith and Mavis Beatty and Oliver and Sheena Lorne, among others. They very kindly tried to teach me the most basic rudiments of their codebreaking work. Now, stupidly, on first meeting, particularly with Mr. and Mrs. Beatty, they took me through some of these rudiments and they asked me, "So, have you got that?" I said, yes, I have. They could see the ignorance in my eyes. It was just absolutely hopeless. And then on the train back, I had to ring up Mrs. Beatty and say, "I lied. I didn't understand a word of it. Could you take me through it again?" She had to take me through it again three times. That induction into complexity helped me enormously in understanding the intensity of life at Bletchley Park. Not just the fearsome logistical gymnastics, but also the physical strain. Night after night, scanning those five-letter groups of random letters, searching in vain for any tiny chink, any infinitesimal chance of getting some leverage into the code. And all this while lethal U-boat wolf packs were sinking Allied convoys, strangling Britain's lifelines and putting her very survival at risk. Now, a few of the codebreakers and machine-operating Wrens did have nervous breakdowns, and perhaps the only reason more people didn't was that most recruits were very young, more adaptable, perhaps, better able to deal with the sleep-shattering work patterns. But this also meant that off-duty hours at Bletchley were pretty intense too. After such unfathomable pressure, the codebreakers needed ways to depressurize. Now, in such a youthful atmosphere, romance was pervasive. It sounds awful to say this, but the clichés really are true. British women, and Bletchley's women were no exceptions, were bowled over by the influx of American men. Wrens lived for their rare nights off when they would go dancing. Some saw Glenn Miller and his band playing live just outside Bedford. And Bletchley had its fair share of Anglo-American lovins. There were some marriages resulting. The other major concern at Bletchley was the physical health of the codebreakers and the practical issue of sunshine and vitamin D, because after so many night shifts working under blackouts or so many day shifts stuck in dark huts, the codebreakers needed as much light as they could get. There was even a special sunray parlour installed at the back of Hut 10. Or there was the simpler solution of sitting outside. But sometimes codebreakers could come under attack from the perpetually furious geese that lived on the lake and bitterly resented their presence. Now, a community of the most electric intellects, in their valuable time off, what entertainments would such amazing prodigies amuse themselves with? Well, as I've mentioned, there was the dancing. They all loved dancing. The house's ballroom thumped and shook with feet. There were formal dances. There was Highland dancing. Senior codebreaker Hugh Foss. Well, by day, he was wrestling with the complexities of Japanese codes, which, as you can imagine, was several degrees of complexity extra. He was an ardent dancer, and his speciality was the eights and reels. In his spare time, though, he would devise new Highland reels. He would go about Bletchley Park wearing a kilt. He wasn't Scottish, but he had a huge enthusiasm for all things for Gaelic. Meanwhile, in the winter, and some of those wartime winters obviously were really quite harsh, the lake froze over and there was skating. The Americans arrived and some of the skating became furiously competitive. Then there were amateur dramatics. I say amateur, but the production values of the Bletchley Park troupe were incredibly high. They performed everything from Shakespeare to J.B. Priestley knockabout comic revues. They put on shows around the county. The money raised through ticket sales was donated to regimental charities. Their audiences obviously had no idea what part these people were playing in the war effort. But when the war ended, local newspaper hacks, still none the wiser, expressed regret that these talented actors would be around no more. Now, incidentally, one of these thespians was the codebreaker Bryn Newton-John, who was the father of Olivia Newton-John. A minor celeb point in there, but actually the other curious thing about the Bletchley story is the huge amount of music that runs through it. I mentioned at the start, some of the recruits to Bletchley were drawn into it, not through maths or through linguistics, but because they had the ability to read a full orchestral score. There was some relationship between code breaking and the structures of music, and there were some brilliant musicians at the park. One of the codebreakers, Jane Fawcett, for instance, after she left Bletchley Park at the end of the war, she immediately joined the Royal Academy of Music, and she became a professional opera singer. There was also a fantastic codebreaker called James Barnard, who had been a protege of Benjamin Britten. Music suffused his entire life. He went on to do all sorts of extraordinary things with music. He composed the film scores for the Hammer horror films, of all things. So Bletchley Park codebreaker composed the score for Dracula, Prince of Darkness. That's hinterland. Now, the young undergraduates are one thing. The smart debutantes were another. These amazingly exotic creatures would only have been known to many of the townsfolk by what they read in the newspaper gossip columns. There were all sorts of artistic types, too, because the other means of recruitment was also through, odd enough, poetry. Bletchley Park had a few poets, too, presumably because poets feel the beating heart of language. It's all about the structures and rhythms of language. Now, much favoured, more amateur dramatics, as you can see, they were all go at Bletchley Park. Much favoured by senior codebreakers Gordon and Welshman and Hugh Alexander in particular was the Shoulder of Mutton public house, which is not too far from the boundary fence of Bletchley. The beers were very fine, apparently, and also crucially, at a time of rationing, the landlady's food was apparently sensational. Now, there was a local rumour that the codebreakers would sit in the saloon bar conversing in ancient Greek. Perhaps it was a security measure. But there was another local rumour that Bletchley Park was in fact a special government lunatic asylum. Now, in that, they might not have been too far off the mark. Now, Bletchley Park played host to a number of women and men who would later to become the defining voices of a generation. I'm sure many of you will recognise here Lord Jenkins of Hillhead, Roy Jenkins. He worked at Bletchley Park from 1944 onwards. By his own admittance, he was a useless codebreaker. He tried and tried, head against brick wall, but he must have got somewhere because they kept him on. He worked valiantly at the Lawrence Codes, and of course later he became one of Britain's most influential Home Secretaries. Now, the Honourable Sarah Baring, who, after working at Bletchley, worked at the Admiralty, told me that she used to run into Jenkins at smart Whitehall parties in the 1960s and the 1970s. They recognised each other. But would they ever discuss Bletchley? Absolutely not. The Official Secrets Act could certainly not be broken over canapes. But, she said, they did wink at one another. A wink, I suggest, that could have meant anything from Roy Jenkins, but there we are. Another frequent visitor to the park was a man from Naval Intelligence, one of the very few allowed to know exactly what was happening at the site. His name, of course, was Ian Fleming. Now, in 1953, he secured immortality with his first James Bond novel, Casino Royale. But there's a nice irony here. During the war, Bletchley's work was very strictly hidden, and that meant keeping MI5 operatives and MI6 operatives in the dark as well. They weren't allowed to know about it. The point is that if 007 had been real, he would not have been allowed to know about Bletchley Park, still less would he have been allowed into the premises. But have a look at Fleming's Bond novels now. Like everyone else, he signed the Official Secrets Act. But when he wrote From Russia with Love in 1957, did the encryption machine called the Spector, portable, typewriter-like, hint rather naughtily at the real thing? Equally, in 1964's You Only Live Twice, set in Japan, there is much discussion about the Japanese code system of Magic 44, which again bore a startling similarity to the real thing. So, after the war, what was to become of this sleek, super-efficient code-breaking base? Well, obviously, it was very sad. In 1946, they began to pack the house up. This what had become a code-breaking factory, breaking thousands upon thousands of codes each day. With the end of the war, obviously, a number of people wanted to get back to civilian life, but there was a core group of code-breakers who stayed on. What they did was they went around the house, they went around the property, and they systematically removed everything that they could find, all the machinery, all the paperwork, all the decrypts. But there was quite a body of key staff who decided they were going to stay on, because even before the end of the war, they knew the next conflict was going to begin. They were back onto Soviet code-breaking duties. They were there at the very start of the Cold War, and the Bletchley Park operation was moved to Eastcote, which is a lovely suburb in northwest London, near the end of the Piccadilly line. Meanwhile, I'll go back a bit, actually, because we've got a lovely picture here of Alan Turing. Alan Turing, after the war, continued with his pioneering computer work. Thanks to films like The Imitation Game, in which he was played by Benedict Cumberbatch, I suppose the abiding image we have of Alan Turing is a melancholic one. A gay man who was persecuted by the authorities, prosecuted by the authorities, forced to take a form of chemical castration, and who ended up taking his own life. Now, obviously, it is a monstrous and very, very sad story, but what the film didn't quite pick up on, and what Cumberbatch didn't quite pick up on, was that before all that, at Bletchley, and just after Bletchley, Alan Turing had actually been quite a cheery soul. He was mischievous. He was funny. He had a laugh that was so irritating that it could make people leave the room. And he was much sought after. He was very popular. He moved to Manchester. He was very popular academically, and he did terrific work in helping to bring the computer age as we now know it into being. He died aged 42. We can only imagine what he would have gone on to do had he lived longer. But the point is that his legacy is still all around us, but the legacy of so many other codebreakers too, including Max Newman, Bill Tutt. And as we see, awful, isn't it? What happened to Bletchley Park after the war? Parts of the grounds were used, I think, by the GPO. They were used by various other organisations around Milton Keynes. But the place started falling to bits. In the 1990s, however, he didn't quite turn up then. In the 1990s, the Bletchley Park Trust thought, right, we've got to get a hold of this and restore it. And they started work on the restoration. As you can see, they had a heartbreaking amount of work to do. By the contrast now, if you go and visit Bletchley Park Museum now, and I do urge you to, because they've done the most amazing job of restoration, you can see the huts recreated as they were, even with ashtrays, with cigarettes in them, desks and everything. They've done a wonderful job. It's a real, real labour of love. And it helped that the park started to attract guest stars, such as the much-lamented late Sir Roger Moore, who again, as James Bond, realised that he wouldn't have been allowed anywhere near it in real life. And work went on. The park also became a fantastic meeting point for all those who had never been allowed to say a word about it. Because think, after the war, all those who'd fought in the war had their organisations and reunions to go to on a sort of annual basis. They could keep up with friends because they knew exactly who had been who. This wasn't the case in Bletchley Park. It was so compartmentalised and so secret that people in Hut 6 weren't allowed to know what was going on in Hut 8. Even married couples, famously, from across the huts weren't allowed to tell each other. It was only in the 1980s when all this started to thaw. And in the 1990s, Bletchley Park started organising annual reunions. So finally, at last, the veterans could come to celebrate this extraordinary achievement that they'd pulled off. And the reunions still go on. It's the first weekend in September every year. I mean, obviously, the numbers are dwindling each year, but it's fantastic of emotional contact point, both for the codebreakers and for their relatives, who can finally understand just the sheer astonishing magnitude of what they did. Now, the park obviously had a fantastic visit from Her Majesty the Queen, too. Here we see her with Jean Valentine, who is a magnificent lady. In fact, I'm seeing her for lunch next week. She lives in Henley, and she still gives talks about her time code breaking when she was in Ceylon. She was sent over to Ceylon to break Japanese codes. Now, here we see Jean Valentine explaining the complex inner workings of the bomb machines to Her Majesty, and there we see Her Majesty pretending to understand. Now, as that happens, I know exactly what Jean Valentine and the Queen were talking about here, but if I was to tell you, someone would have to come and kill me, because she made me sign the Official Secrets Act. And I would hope, though, that if you get a chance, do go to Bletchley, because the point is that now there is a chance to celebrate what had been a great mass of dark matter at the heart of British history. Think about how much British history had to be rewritten as soon as the Bletchley Park revelations started to come into the public view in the 1980s and the 1990s. Now, the fascinating thing about the story is that even though myself, Michael Smith, all sorts of other people have covered it, you still sense there are patches, there are black holes, there are still patches of dark matter, there's still more to be discovered. There are still more descendants of codebreakers who realised possibly too late what their mothers and fathers and grandfathers had done. And so the Bletchley Park Roll of Honour, if you're in that position, the Bletchley Park Roll of Honour is consistently updated and it's always worth checking out. And with that, thank you very much. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.